I will work day in and day out, wake up and smell the coffee.
I want to return to the European Union.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Nye Davis, a lecturer in politics at Cardiff University, focusing on the Labour Party and Welsh politics, to discuss a new book that he has published, edited by him, This Is My Truth, a Noran Bevin in Tribune. Welcome to the podcast, Nye.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. Now, the first question I'd like to ask is, what made you want to produce this collection of Bevin's articles from Tribune?
Well, I started doing a PhD about 8 years ago, and my PhD was looking at the political thought of an Noran Bevin. I was interested in trying to get to the heart of his ideas, and also looking at his legacy within the Labour Party today, and those ideas have sort of been taken on within the party. And when I started my research, I was quite surprised right from the off that there wasn't a huge amount of published work by Bevin. There was Bevin's In Place of Fear, there was his book Why Not Trust the Tories that he wrote under a pseudonym. There's lots of speeches and parliamentary debate and things like that out there, and quotes, some of them real, some of them not real. But I was surprised that his Tribune articles hadn't been published, or not many of them had been published, because there's over 300 of them, not including the editorials when he was the editor. So right from the beginning of doing the research, I thought, well, it's quite a shame that these are in an archive. So I had the idea as I was writing my PhD, and then when I finished my PhD a few years ago, to publish my PhD as a book, which will be out next year. But I wanted to get Bevin's writings out there. I wanted the opportunity for Bevin's truths to be put out there, because one of the reasons I studied Bevin was because of those competing claims and the debates over Bevin's legacy and the precise nature of his politics. So I thought this was a good opportunity before I put my analysis out there, to allow Bevin the opportunity to, as the title says, to tell his own truth in that sense. So there's about 72 articles in there, which is a lot of articles, but it's still only a fraction of what he wrote in Tribune. But I thought it was important to get these writings out there and in a more accessible format.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And what I think is so interesting, as you say in the introduction, is that Bevin is well known in terms of his speeches, and they are, as you say, sometimes the quotations from them are not entirely accurate or somewhat misattributed. But what I think is so interesting is the emphasis so much, as you say in the introduction, on him being an orator, being a speechmaker, and that neglect of a lot of his writing. Why do you think that is? Is it simply the case that because these articles were published in individual issues of Tribune, the readership of them was not as great as it could have been? Was it just that the scale and power of his oratory sometimes made people focus on that more than necessarily on his writing? Why do you think there's been this emphasis really on his speech making and not so much on his article writing?
I think that's an interesting question, because I think it's a bit of both, really. I think his oratory is so powerful. I mean, you just have to read his speeches to get a sense of how great an orator he was, and then when you actually get the opportunity to listen to him speak and to watch some of his speeches, they are very powerful. And so I think maybe that overshadows the writing a bit. And I think you're right in terms of the type of writing Bevin was doing. These weren't systematic pieces of writing in terms of they were articles week by week in Tribune. And then In Place of Fear was the only book there was, as I said, his book in 1944, Why Not Trust the Tories, that was quite a short book. In Place of Fear was the only real book of political analysis that Bevin produced, and it had its critics. A lot of people said that it was, the ideas in the book were, in Place of Fear, were outdated, I would disagree with that somewhat, but I think that was the only systematic or attempted being systematic that Bevan produced. So I think maybe that's why people focus on his oratory perhaps more than his writings, because his writings were also quite inaccessible beyond In Place of Fear. So it's really the oratory, the recordings of him, the speeches in Labour Conference and in Hansard, they were the ones that were accessible. So I think what I hope with this book is that people can see he wasn't just an orator. He was actually quite a good writer as well. I think his writing is quite journalistic, but it's underpinned by a guide in political philosophy, which I think makes his writing in many cases just as powerful as his oratory.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think what's interesting as well is the scale of time which he was producing articles in Tribune from 1937, 1938, all the way until his death in 1960. What do you think that allows us in terms of an audience reading those articles, not just to see about how Bevan's own political philosophy evolved, but also how the Labour Party changed? Because it's quite an extensive period, and of course you've got the Second World War in the middle of that. What do you think that the articles reflect on the way that both Bevan and the Labour Party changed during that period?
Yeah, well, I think with Bevan, when I was putting the collection together, I was in two minds whether I divide it by period to make it all chronological or make the chapters thematic and then chronological through there. So I had a bit of a tricky time deciding that. Mm. But I think in the way it's structured in looking at the key themes, I think it shows potentially two things about Bevan. The first is that for Bevan, a lot of his political thought stayed quite constant. He was guided by this underpinning political philosophy, which I would argue didn't change a huge amount throughout his career. And critics of Bevan say that as well, say that was a weakness of Bevan that it didn't change. But I think he does adapt, and he does adapt to different situations. But it has been underpinned by that political thought. So I think the constant is there. I think that's the first thing about Bevan. And then the second thing is, because these writings are quite journalistic, he's reacting to what's going on in the world. So I think I found that quite interesting when you look at these through the different themes, but also through looking at them as a chronology, is he's constantly reacting to different situations, which means his political philosophy is being tested. So what these articles do is show how he tries to maintain that political philosophy but react to different situations. So it shows the development of Bevan's political thought, to take into account, I mean, his articles between 1937 and 1945 are very preoccupied with war and the build-up of World War II. And then afterwards, in the 1950s, particularly his writings on the international situation, you see him developing his thought there somewhat, because he's talking about the new world that's been created and the power politics that's been established. So he's trying to adapt to that situation. So I think in terms of the development of Bevan's political philosophy, I think there are some consistent themes there, but also some changes, and I think how they interact is quite interesting. And I think in terms of the Labour Party, I think one thing it does show, rather than a development, it's always history repeating itself in terms of the disagreements going on with the party, because in the lead up to World War II, of course Bevan was expelled from the party at one point, and later on in the 50s then he almost got expelled again. So that's, in terms of the Labour Party, I think it firstly demonstrates the disagreements that are still going on today, and they just keep coming back around. But it also shows as well, I think, what these articles show is that ideological conflict within the party. There's some really interesting articles by Bevan. There's a chapter there on the Labour Party and the trade unions. And it's really fascinating seeing seeing how Bevan conceptualizes the Labour Party. He sees the Labour Party as a force for good, and through the Labour Party you can achieve great things. But he's always frustrated by the party as well, and he's not afraid to speak his mind, which is quite interesting. I mean, some of the things that he writes in there, I don't know how long you would last in the party today if he was writing that stuff, but I think it shows that ideological conflict, and within that period, particularly in the 1950s, when the Bevanites and the Gaitskellites, I think there was a personality clash there between Bevan and Gaitskell. But I think ideologically, they had quite different views on the best way to try and achieve change. And I think these articles demonstrate Bevan's position within that. Because quite often, when I was looking at the literature on the Labour Party in this period, particularly the studies of Labour Parties, the Labour Party's political thought, its ideology, Bevan kind of gets dismissed somewhat. That argument I said earlier, that he never really changed his ideas from pre-war, and he didn't adapt to the post-war post-war society. So in a lot of these studies of Labour's political thought, Bevan and the Bevanites are seen as not as effective in terms of arguing for their ideas and putting forth their ideas coherently. But I think what this book shows is that there is something there. It's not systematic. So people like Anthony Crosland wrote the Future of Socialism. Mm-hmm. Bevan never really produced a text was that detailed, and I think a lot of his writing in the 1950s. In the 1940s, his writing seems to be quite goes deeper in terms of his analysis of the role of the state and the role of Parliament. The 1950s, that kind of fades away a bit, I think, and it goes back to first principles. But I think what this book demonstrates and in terms of the Labour Party, I think, is Bevan's contribution to the Labour Party's intellectual development. And I think that's quite important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think what the book really demonstrates as well is that people often think of Bevan only in relation to the NHS and domestic policy. But of course, he had a great deal of interest and spent a lot of time thinking about international affairs as well. He was, of course, Shadow Foreign Secretary as well. What do you think this collection, what do you think his essays specifically relating to international affairs show about Bevan's thinking in terms of Britain in the wider world and British politics as compared to European and American politics, and also how interlinked Bevan saw his own brand of socialism with international socialist movements?
With Britain's place in the world, I think Bevan in the 1950s in particular saw Britain's place in the world as diminishing somewhat. You had this the power politics going on between the USA and the Soviet Union, and I think Bevan saw attempts by the British government, obviously mainly conservative government in the 1950s, of trying to maintain its position as a world power. I think Bevan saw that as unrealistic. So there's some really interesting articles there where Bevan talks about the Suez Crisis, and obviously saw that as an outrage by the British government to take part in that, and saw it as this one last ditch attempt to try and reclaim Britain's superior position on the world stage. So I think Bevan saw Britain's role as diminishing quite significantly post World War II. So what Bevan sought as an alternative is for Britain not to get too engrossed or too engaged in this power politics. The world was divided by two camps: capitalist USA, communist Soviet Union, and Bevan didn't want Britain to kind of join either side of these. Essentially, he argued for a third way in British politics, there's some interesting articles there about India and about Yugoslavia and about China. And Bevan saw these countries as rejecting the divide between the two camps, and saw a third way, sort of a precursor to the non-aligned movement, really. And Bevan, I think, wanted Britain to be part of that. He wanted Britain to still have a role on the world stage. He wanted to be an important role on the world stage, but didn't want military might to be the basis of that role. So Bevan wanted to build links with countries like India, with countries like Yugoslavia, who he saw as pulling themselves away from this political divide, from this ideological divide. So I think that was really important for Bevan. And he saw all this being done through the United Nations. I think he saw the United Nations. He had a real vision for the UN, that this was an opportunity for nations of the world to come together and to work collectively. And he wanted Britain to have a big role in that. So he saw Britain's role declining, but at the same time, particularly after the establishment of the NHS, this I think comes out in the articles, is he did think Britain had a role to play in terms of being the taking moral leadership in the world. And I think that's what Bevan was getting at when he kind of tried to reject military power in favor of international cooperation. Is that he said he had a lot of admiration for the development of British democracy and the fight for democracy in Britain and how that developed over time. And I think even though he was critical, I think he had a great appreciation for the role of Parliament and the role of British political institutions. So when he writes about developing countries around the world, Bevan looks at these countries and said, well, we need to provide economic aid to these countries, and we need to develop their economies, but we also need to it's kind of a British exceptionalism in a way, that British democracy should be spread throughout the world, and the way to do that is to help countries and to support countries and not get yourself involved in various wars. So I think the articles in the book demonstrate Bevan trying to apply his principles, his own interpretation of democratic socialism, trying to apply those to the rest of the world. And he saw that being done not through military might, but by international cooperation, Britain playing a role in that, and also economic development as well. And he felt that was the way you could improve international relations then.
Mm-hmm. Something that really comes through in particularly in some of the early articles in the book is Bevan's emphasis, real vociferous emphasis on the need for improvement to housing. And of course, as in the Attlee government, he was responsible for housing as well as healthcare. What do you think drove that kind of focus? Do you think it was a realisation as to how poor the housing stock in Britain was, just in terms of his experience as an MP? Do you think it went further back to his own youth and to his own upbringing? Where do you think that focus on housing came from?
I think it goes back to his upbringing. Mm. I think because one of the interesting things about Bevan's time as a housing minister is he was criticised for not building enough houses after World War II. And I can't remember who it was who said that Bevan was a Tory when it came to houses, because he wanted good quality houses. And he was criticised for putting quality over quantity by some people. But for Bevan, he said, well, the working class deserve good housing. The working people of this country deserve good quality housing. And he grew up in South Wales as a coal miner. He would have seen small houses and lots of people living in these houses. And he didn't want a situation where people had bad housing. It needed to be good quality housing for people. So I think it comes from that from his early life that instilled in him the importance of good quality housing. And it's just one of the different aspect. I think one thing that, particularly when we look at Bevan today and we look at Bevan and the NHS today, there is a tendency to look at Bevan's, the NHS being free at the point of delivery, that that Bevan principle, as the be all and end all. But for Bevan, the NHS was part of a wider transformation of society. And I think housing was part of that. So he wanted to create thriving communities. He talked about, you know, you could leave your house and there'd be the butcher would be there and the bakers would be there, and part of a thriving community where people live together, work together, and were healthy and had good jobs. And so housing was one part of that that wider focus. And I think it shows with the sheer variety of topics Bevan talks about in the book, that he saw this as all interconnected then.
Absolutely. And you touched upon it a bit earlier, but one of the things that's also really interesting is Bevan's discussion of parliamentary democracy and how important parliament was and its role within the state. What do you think was at the root of this particular interest in the kind of, like, not just the active role of parliament as an MP, but also thinking about its role in a more almost constitutional and kind of like academic sense as well?
It's for Bevan, there's a tendency in some of the literature to see Bevan's early days in Tredegar and his time in parliament as being quite separate, that this theme sort of emerged, and I think maybe Michael Foot's biography kind of lent credence to this. That Bevan in Tredegar was a syndicalist. He was of course he was a trade unionist, but some see that there was a dichotomy in Bevan's thinking between industrial action and parliament. And Bevan himself, when he wrote In Place of Fear, gives the suggestion that, well, up until about 1926, Bevan was Bevan saw power at the point of production. So Bevan says when it got to the Triple Alliance of 1919 and then the 1926 general strike, there was an opportunity for the workers to seize power in that way, but it never happened because the leaders didn't reckon with the subjective attitudes of the people, he described it, to Parliament and its institutions. So the kind of story of Bevan's life is seen as a, well, in he used to be a syndicalist and then he became a parliamentarian. But I think for Bevan, he always saw the importance of the political wing and the industrial wing. And I think Bevan had a great reverence for British Parliament because he saw it as, well, eventually it became very democratic. And it speaks to his political thought as well, that I think some of the most interesting articles to really try and understand Bevan's political thought is when he writes about China and the Soviet Union. So for Bevan, he didn't like their undemocratic aspects of these countries, but believed that once the state was in charge of the economy and had power over the economy and could introduce economic planning and public ownership, that eventually over time people would start demanding for increased liberty and increased democratic rights, and then you'll see the flourishing of democracy in these countries. And he saw Britain in this sense, that the Industrial Revolution was developing, workers demanded increasing recognition and increasing rights, therefore they were given rights, and Parliament was a way for their views to be heard, and the country over time became more democratic. So for Bevan then, when he gets to Parliament in 1929, he sees this, he talks about it a number of times, where he says that Parliament is a weapon in the class struggle. And In Place of Fear, he sets out this almost like working class versus ruling class, is poverty versus property. So poverty in millions of people in this country, property are those who control private property and control the wealth. But then there was a third element, democracy. And Bevan said, poverty uses democracy to destroy property. So Bevin really had this view of Parliament as, well, this is really transformative Parliament. That if we can get socialists, a majority in Parliament of socialists, we can start to take control of the economy and transform society. But he didn't think you could just get a majority in Parliament and then that's it. You can start implementing everything you want then. And there's an article in the book where Bevin says that, well, the way of thinking of a lot of socialists in Britain was that once you get a majority, then you can put your policies in place. But he said it's much more difficult than that because you have to deal with vested interests outside of Parliament. You have to deal with the House of Lords. You have to deal with the justice system, with the police. There are so many different aspects of the state that you need to grapple with first before you truly have power. But Bevin thought the British constitution was flexible enough that if you got a majority of socialists in power, a majority of socialists in Parliament, then you could start transforming things. I think his experience in the NHS probably solidified that within him. He said, well, look what we achieved in 1948, the establishment of the health service. This was a huge achievement. So in the 1950s then, when he's going through these debates with the Labour Party, and probably a lot of critics on the left of the Labour Party would have said, it's useless, Bevin. You need to, if you really want change, you need to come out the party. But he had this belief that if we can get a majority in Parliament, we can start to try and capture power then. I think that was key for Bevin. He saw a real revolutionary role for Parliament, which I would argue led him to neglect some other aspects of particularly extra-parliamentary movements and things that could be achieved that way. But it was a fundamental element of his political thought that you could use Parliament to take power. Getting a majority, so the Labour Party being the majority party in Parliament, that doesn't mean power. That doesn't mean you're in power, because power is outside of Parliament, it's within the state, it's within the economy. But you could use the instruments of Parliament to obtain power for the majority of people then.
Absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast now. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak to me. But I do have one final question for you. For anyone who is reading the book, who has read the book, what do you hope that they will take away from it in terms of not just Bevin's writing, but also his place in history?
Yeah, I think for me, when I started doing my research into Bevin, it was very clear to me, the reason I chose Bevin, not just because I'm called Nye, but it was very clear to me with my interest in Welsh politics and Labour politics that Bevin seemed to be this totemic figure. You can't read a Welsh Labour, particularly a Welsh Labour politician speech, without seeing Bevin's name coming up. And I mean, Keir Starmer recently was referencing Bevin. So he's got this real power within the Labour Party. But I think there's still disagreements over who Bevin is and what his politics represented. There are those who saw Bevin as a radical socialist who stood up for his principles no matter what. Others see him as a kind of pragmatic institution builder and an institutional pioneer within Britain, who understood the need to compromise. So I think I've tried to make my own contribution to those debates in the work that I've done, and as I said in the book that will be coming out next year on Bevin's political thought. But I hope with this book that what I hope people get out of this and take away from this is firstly the importance of Bevin. I think particularly in trying to understand those debates within the 1950s. Bevin, the name Bevin is important, but I think the ideas that Bevin represented, I think, are important as well to consider. But I think the main thing I want people to take from this book is seeing Bevin or reading Bevin's own words, to take a step back from those debates, to take a step back from all those arguments, and to just read Bevin as he was and try and make a judgment based on Bevan's own words. And I think this is a really good opportunity for people to do that. Because as I said, when I started my research, I had preconceptions about Bevan, which were changed quite significantly when I started reading his work in a bit more detail. I hope that's what people get out of it. That Bevan is an interesting figure. I think he's an important figure, but it's a real opportunity for people to read Bevan in a bit more detail in his own words. So essentially, don't listen to anything I say about Anira Bevan. Read Bevan himself.
I totally concur with that. It is a fantastic book. I hope people go out and buy it if they haven't already bought it. Thanks so much again for coming on the podcast tonight. If people want to find out more about you and get a copy of the book, where should they go to find out more about you and get a copy of the book?
So I'm on Twitter. I'm a sporadic tweeter at Nye_Davis. And you can buy a copy of the book from the University of Wales Press.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Diolch yn fawr.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.